disciplinary award of attorney fees on the rest.
Something we can take care of now.
We're putting a floor, we really can't carry much over.
I think my attorney had a budget deleted on the last.
I have problems with section three that maybe I could be talked out of, but I just need to walk my way through it. I don't think anyone else take the time now to do that. These were adopted conceptually, and I'm not sure that the language that we've gotten and are just now seeing it the first time gets there.
Well, let's pass over it for the time. Can you review it over the next hour or so or so?
And come back to that.
This is the ambulance lien bill. Can I hand out a hand of gross version with some language from legislative council that was conceptually adopted?
I don't remember. There's any of that.
Bill is originally a city which provided ambulance services to claim an ambulance lien similar to the hospital lien that all hospitals can claim right now, which is essentially if services are extended to an injured person, the ambulance company could send a formal notice to both the insurer and any person who might be liable to the injured person. The notice would essentially let that insurer or the tortfeasor know that they had to pay the ambulance company before pay off their charges, or else they'd be liable to the ambulance company. The committee amended it to broaden it to all ambulance companies, whether or not they're provided by a governmental entity, amended the timing and the form of notice to conform to the procedures used for existing hospital liens, and also amended it so that the notice of lien could be sent by either registered or certified mail, not just certified mail is present law. And so with these conceptual amendments, it was passed out with the do-pass amendment, or do-pass motion.
I move the amendments 2835-1. Page 68383, the House Bill 2835.
Representative Clinton moves the dash one amendments. Representative Smith, have you had it? Is there objection?
2835 is amended with full forward do-pass recommendation.
Representative Clinton moves House Bill 2835 as amended be reported with a do-pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Call the roll.
Courtney?
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Longhorn?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Skamir?
No.
Smith?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Myers?
Aye.
Senate Bill 127.
I think Representative Hill ought to carry that last bill.
He has too much.
He will.
Too much.
She's there.
She's in too much.
Mr. Chair.
I did all the work on those.
We'll carry it.
Mr. Chair.
Senate Bill 127.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Scudero.
Within how much time do I have to notify you of a possible minority report?
By the end of today's meeting.
Thank you. when do I have to serve notice of possible reconsideration?
Would you please get control of this committee?
This bill.
If you do, it upsets me. I'll so far, I'm quite comfortable with what they're doing. Thanks, Molly. Senate Bill 127.
Okay, this bill does just one thing. It adds to the list of people who can prosecute a civil suit to set aside a transfer which violates the present laws for people on public assistance and so forth. The present laws say you're not supposed to transfer property if you're on public assistance. You're not really supposed to have the property either. The division, at present, the division or the personal representative of the estate of a deceased recipient can go after this property that was transferred in violation of the statute and get it back. And then the division, if they choose to, go after the property and to reimburse it for funds that it paid out, which it shouldn't have paid. The department wanted to add conservator for the recipient as another person who is specifically statutorily authorized to prosecute a civil action simply on the basis that this would make it easier for a conservator to get back this property. Without this law, they would have to go on general equitable theories and so forth of wrongful transfers and all the rest of it. There was some testimony, and there's a letter in everyone's file from the Adult Family Services Division for Mr. Putnam, clarifying that it's not the department's intent to either get themselves appointed as conservator or to set up a situation where the property is returned to the estate or the possession of the person on public assistance and then put back into the department's pockets. This is not intended to put them in a conflict of interest situation where they are getting a conservator appointed who is not looking after the best interests of the recipient. Instead, it's simply to give the conservator the same statutory power to set aside these things as the department presently has. They're not in a position generally to go after these wrongful transfers. There was one amendment that was suggested, and I believe it was adopted. Yes, it was adopted by the committee. It's simply in line 15 of the printed bill to, before the word may, to insert the Adult and Family Services Division. It doesn't make sense when you add the conservator at line 12. The latter part of the sentence doesn't make sense unless you clarify that it's only the Adult and Family Services Division which can recover out of the property the amount of any public assistance which was given to the recipient. So that amendment was adopted, and it comes to the full committee with the due passage amendment recommendation.
The motion on the bill is amended.
I move to the floor due passage recommendation.
The Courtney News Senate Bill 127 as amended be reported with the due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? I wonder if this one would be appropriate for the consent calendar.
Include that in my motion, Mr. Chair.
Yes, I will. Let the bill be included on the consent calendar, placed on the consent calendar. Is there further discussion? All the right, please.
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Skinner?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Myers?
Aye.
I'll let go. He's got to carry something on water. He's got to do something about it.
2717. This bill is the last of the fairly substantial juvenile law package that the committee has reported.
I think this is the last piece of it.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I've passed out you a copy of Hannon Gross House Bill 2717 with LC amendments, House Bill 2717-1.
When did you pass them out?
What date?
When did you pass them out?
The amendments?
Yeah, you said you passed them. You just, you do it today?
Oh,
just on the way right there.
Sorry.
That's why I couldn't find the
phone. I don't have the problem. Did I have the bill, please?
And there's a copy of the LC amendments.
Why would you want?
Dated June 6, 1983. This bill makes a number of changes in the statutes that relate to the expunction of juvenile records. Section 1 under the definition of record expands the list of items that are excluded from the definition, therefore would not be subject to expunction. The only exceptions now are transcripts of academic records of McLaren or Hillcrest and material that's necessary for obtaining federal financial participation regarding financial assistance or services. The additions in Section 1 add as exceptions motor vehicles, division records, fish and wildlife, green board, police and court records relating to remand, records related to support obligations, medical records, and so forth. The original bill would have limited the means of obtaining a juvenile record expunction to those who applied and met certain criteria, and would have repealed two other sections that, which are currently the most common means of obtaining expunctions. One which the court does automatically when the juvenile reaches 18, in most cases, depending on circumstances. Sometimes it provides it could be age 21 or where the juvenile case has been dismissed. And another section that has to do with where certain conditions are met and there's an application that there could be a partial or full expunction for those special circumstances. Those are reinstated, well, the repeal is repealed, and one of them has a minor amendment to reference the new criteria for expunction in Section 2. Section 2 of the bill adds to those considerations that now apply to expunction of records the fact that the person is not within the juvenile court on the basis of actions that can bring them before the juvenile court, now excluding the, I think they're the ones that are considered the status offense, the word of the court kinds of sections. In other words, if they committed a crime, what would be a crime if they committed an adult? And I don't remember what the other sections are offhand. And if there's no pending investigation going on, the juvenile department's aware of. There were several sections of the existing law that required a notice of significance of the expunction, the subject's rights relating to expunction, and so forth. Those sections are deleted, and Section 5 combines those into one section and lists there at what juncture the notice must be provided. Section 6 establishes where the expunction proceeding takes place, that is, in the county where the child resided at the time of the most recent termination. Section 7 is the procedure to follow when the expunction is by application. Section 8 adds the notice provision. Right now, the district attorney of the county where the record sought to be expunged is kept. There would be an additional notice required to the DA of the county in which the expunction proceeding is commenced. Section 10 provides that the court can proceed with or without a hearing on expunction, except that it could not deny an expunction without a hearing if the subject of the expunction has applied or if there's timely objection filed. It also establishes the applicable rules of evidence and puts the burden of proof on the person contesting the expunction. Subsection 3, I guess I'll just highlight one of the most significant sections. Subsection 3 of Section 11, Subsection 2 establishes a deadline by which the agencies that have not indicated compliance within 6 weeks, the juvenile court will provide the person that's subject to the record the list of those agencies. And Subsection 3 provides that in addition to the other identified agencies, the other courts, juvenile, circuit, district, municipal, and justice courts are covered by expunction orders and district and city attorneys. There's apparently been some questions about whether it applied to all of them. Section 13 is a right of action for when a person intentionally violates the confidentiality provisions. That replaces an existing, there already is a right of action, and this is basically replaces that with this new section. It contains the same limitation of punitive damages of up to an amount of $1,000 as amended by the subcommittee. Some of the other, Section 14, Section 15 establishes that records can be destroyed when there was a question relating to whether expunction means they can destroy records. The bill, as amended, would provide that they would maintain a list of those who were ordered to expunge records, but that the records themselves could be destroyed. The rest are basically conforming amendments changing statutory sections, references.
Any questions?
The dash one, let's discuss dash one amendments.
I think they were adopted in subcommittee.
Some of them were conceptual.
Okay, Representative Courtney moves the dash one amendments to 2717. Is there any objection?
2717 is amended to the floor, do pass.
And Courtney moves House Bill 2717 as amended to the floor, do pass recommendation. Is there further discussion?
Courtney?
Yes.
Hill?
Aye.
Lombard?
Aye.
Miller?
Aye.
Rivera?
Aye.
Smith?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye.
Rutherford?
Aye.
Aye. 2645, Representative Smith, are you in a position yet to have any sense of whether we can realistically expect to proceed?
You can highlight my concerns, and then Mr. Hall and I have been commiserating a possible solution. For members not on that subcommittee, Representative Brulee proposed to us at the request of one of our constituents a bill that would come out pretty hard on someone who would cloud the title to one's home by falsely filing a construction lien, knowing full well that they were entitled to the lien. And in the subcommittee, we adopted conceptually some notions, but in reviewing them now in print, I'm concerned about the following. Both in the criminal sanctions in Section 2 and the civil counterpart of that, the components which give the scienter or the knowledge that create the cause of action or give rise to the criminal complaint are similar to activities which in the common course of litigation of these things you could easily run afoul of. And I think we have, as Kirk has mentioned, sophisticated persons in this area suing sophisticated persons or seeking criminal law. What I'm fearing is that you can have lawyers suing lawyers, because somewhere contained in one of those files at one time or another was just enough of an inkling that maybe you didn't have all the evidence you needed before discovery to file it on that basis. And this brings the claim for relief or the criminal action down on your head. If you look at the language, if you claim a lien or file a complaint to foreclose the lien. Sometimes after you file the lien, you do discover that there are problems with the lien, and I'm not sure under sort of the sporting rules of trial whether at that point you are ethically bound to go to the other side and say, by golly, I misfiled this lien, or whether it is the duty of the other side to say, I've discovered an error in your lien and I've called it to your attention. Oftentimes you go right down to trial and settle, and the document may have been technically invalid, but this would say that if you know of any technical reason why the lien's invalid or should have known, then I think you're criminally liable, both as the attorney who prepared it and continue to pursue it, or as the principal who hired the attorney who may harbor certain knowledge when they swear to the document prepared by the lawyer. And Kirk suggests that we go back to the language at the bottom of page 2, which is crossed out, and basically go with the sham and frivolous approach that we've been working with the Attorney General, which would narrow the numbers of these kinds of actions just to those that are so clearly fraudulent and sham and frivolous they don't belong either on the record title and they don't belong in the courtroom. And further, I know Representative Scudero raised issues that I raised my eyebrow on it, the language that we didn't adopt in subcommittee. At the top of page 2, the $1,000 or 25% issues, which are rather significant if you're in a million-dollar construction situation. So I missed, we did adopt some of these conceptually and brought them up to full committee, but now looking at them, I have some real pause about the policy we're going forward on.
So your recommendation is to preserve what part of the bill?
Well, I suppose, Kirk, we would, in subsection 2, where it, line 7, it says, with knowledge that, and then it goes into the items which constitute the crime, we would substitute for that the sham and frivolous suit language on the bottom of page 2.
Why don't we do this? We're past Mr. Hall's part of the agenda, and I wonder, while we turn to 2087, if you might adjourn your office and see if you could pull together an amended bill that you could control Representative Smith about. Tomorrow is Subcommittee Two's, I think, last meeting on House bills, so we're out of Subcommittee Two time tomorrow. And I think realistically, our only option is either to deploy an amendment bill today or table it.
I know that Representative Scudero, who served on the leading task force, probably would like to share that consultation.
Could you prepare a recommended revised bill and then go back with them if that's what you want, Mr. Hall?
Could I be excused to go back just for a few minutes?
Yes, sure.
Let's go to 2087. I think before we take the money, we might want to spend just a few minutes quickly overviewing the bill. Is Mr. Gruber, or do you want to do that?
Mr. Chair, I'm prepared to go through and just outline for the committee what's basically what's in the bill and where it came from. Mm. Do you want me to go ahead?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Sections one and two. Rename the parole board and also allow the legislative council to substitute words designating supervised release for parole and conditional release. Section 3 was Judge Hargrave's proposal, which is that instead of the judge stating a maximum term for the sentence, the court would sentence for an indeterminate period of time to be made determinant by the board, and would state in the judgment that the sentence shall not exceed the maximum term provided by law. It also sets forth that the board will establish the release date, and also states that the court shall make findings as it determines will assist the board in establishing the determinant sentence and shall include findings in the judgment order. The way that I gave the instruction, as I understood the direction of the committee, I don't know if you want to be more specific about that direction to the court. As I understood it, you wanted to require the trial court to make findings on the record that are pertinent to the application of the matrix. And this, the way that it's worded here, might not be as directive as you may want. I can't find exactly which line it's on, but it's phrased in terms of the... Oh, if you look on page 2, lines 11 to 14, what I'm referring to, where it provides that the court shall make such findings as it determines will assist the State Board of Prison Terms and Supervised Release in determining the sentence. I just have an impression that we may want to be more directive.
Yeah, that's too loose. Assuming we go that direction at all, I think it's going to have to be more directory than that.
Section 4 on page 2 of the amendments picks up the changes in terminology from parole to supervised release. And also, this section in existing law provides that when a prisoner on parole has met obligations for a period that the parole board designates, then they're discharged. The discharge is only within a period of not less than 6 months on parole, except where the sentence imposed by the court expires earlier. The final discharge is by the date of expiration of that sentence. With the judge no longer setting a sentence, the maximum time till discharge, therefore, is therefore not capped by a judge's sentence necessarily, but has been replaced with a reference to the maximum period imposed by law, which could be longer than a judge might have imposed, but that's what can be put in as far as is done so far, and would replace that. Section 5 changes the name of the Advisory Commission on Prison Terms and Parole Standards and substitutes supervised release for the reference to parole standards. Section 6 on page 5 is again conforming changes to the terminology. Section 7, beginning page 6. This section has to do with the PSIs furnished to the court in felony cases. This change grew out of a meeting, an informal meeting with representatives of Corrections Division, Parole Board, Community Corrections. It provides that if a convicted person is held in custody, the PSI shall be furnished in 20 days, and if not, held in custody within 30 days. The purpose of this section is to present the issue of guidelines for obtaining timely reports. Obviously more concerned with the timeliness when the person's being held in jail. The local governments are concerned that if the person's eventually going to be transferred to the state penitentiary, that they not be spending additional time, or if they're going to be put on probation in jail. Another subsection of that bill allows the court to authorize an extension of that time period. There was some concern raised as to what is a reasonable time for preparation of these reports, and if this is not, that they may be getting just repeated requests for delays. Section 8 is the minimum mandatory section, and in the present law, in a felony case, the court can impose a minimum of half the sentence that it imposes. Since the judge would no longer be setting a sentence, then the question was, where do you get the meaning for minimum mandatory? And the request was to establish that the court would be allowed to set a mandatory minimum within the range, and provides that the court gave a sentence that went outside the range, then there would be substituted the maximum term that is within the range. Section 10, the bottom of page 7, is an incorporation of Bill Gary's proposed amendments to House Bill 2268 dealing with consecutive sentencing. Section 12 on page 9 incorporates ODAA's House Bill 2267 with ODAA's proposed amendments. That was the anti-merger bill. Section 13 on page 10 incorporates the amended House Bill 2062, which designated the limitations on imposition of community service sentences. Sections 14 and 15 are an incorporation of House Bill 2897. Those are amendments to the sections that provide that a judgment that a criminal defendant pay fines, costs, and disbursements be docketed as a civil judgment and is enforceable as a judgment in a civil action. As amended, it provides that fines includes compensatory fines, and it adds restitution to victims among fines and costs that can be enforced as a judgment in a civil case. Section 16 is a modified combination of Senate Bill 392 and of Senate Bill 86, which was not before us but related to the same matter. The two of them together anyway were to eliminate the requirement that the parole board obtain a statement of facts and information concerning a person's crime from DA, sheriffs, and arresting agencies, since in fact they never send them. The courts sometimes do, but as I understand it, it is very uncommon for DAs or sheriffs or the arresting agencies to send the reports. So the couple changes in here is that rather than the way it was phrased now was that the parole board shall obtain from each of those parties, now it would be restricted to the sentencing court and phrased in terms of the sentencing court shall provide to the board. It also specifies in certain kinds of cases that a transcript of statement of reasons be furnished to the board. In other cases, the board could request them. And those were cases like dangerous offender cases, minimum mandatories, and so forth. Section 17 is also from Senate Bill 86 and related to the case that arose when because the statute required the parole board to consider reports and so forth from DAs and sheriffs and law enforcement. The parole board didn't receive them. Section 17 would provide that the board will consider reports from judges and PSI or its equivalent. Sections 18 and 19 are just additional changes to conform to the changes in terminology of parole. Section 20 is taken from House Bill 2218, which was to limit the time that a person could be held without a warrant from the court on a probation violation. Sections 21 to 23 also were from 2218. They contain the 15-day limit for a hearing by the Division on Probation Violator holds without a court warrant. Sections 24 and 25 would put a similar 15-day limit on the time within which the board would have to consider a hearing, to conduct a hearing when a person was pulled in for parole violation. Section 26 on page 22 was incorporated it came from House Bill 2760, and that had to do with the provision of